You're listening to a Big Finish production.
Big Finish present Doctor Who Short Trips. The Darkened Earth by John Pritchard. Read by Miranda Raisin. Mrs. Clark, the doctor said, would you care to see a world in which your war is just a distant memory? I went to the TARDIS door and hesitated. We had spoken about this before, and I'd made it clear that I didn't want to take some kind of shortcut to see the war's end without earning it. As Mr. Churchill said in that great speech in 1940, our aim was victory in spite of all terror. Victory, however long and hard the road may be. I still believed in that victory, but I knew I had to get there along that road like everybody else. It's not for me to tell you how it ended, said the doctor, but in the universal scheme of things, one idea always holds true. This too shall pass. I felt a sudden tightening of my heartstrings, because good things pass as well as bad, of course. When I married Henry, I believed that it would be forever. We all think we'll live forever, don't we? Even in the middle of a war. I opened the door and stepped into the sunlight. It was a summer evening, warm and quiet. We were in a field beside a narrow lane. Birds were singing in the trees. I turned and looked around me. After all the amazing sights I'd seen, I could only think, this blessed plot, this earth. And we're in England? I asked. Naturally, the doctor said. He was still at the controls. The TARDIS hasn't fixed the date yet, nor the place, in fact. Doctor, are you saying you're not sure about something? I asked him rather naughtily. He gave me a long, suffering sort of look. There's a village about a mile away, I added. We can stroll over there and find out where we are. The low sun would be in our eyes, so I went back for my dark glasses. They were a service issue pair, and the doctor liked to tease me about them, saying the round lenses looked like goggles. It also occurred to me that it might very well be dark when we got back, so I dug out my navy torch as well, the one that Henry gave me. Just a small brass tube with a Morse tapper, but it meant a lot. I put it in the pocket of my jacket. As the girl guides say, one should always be prepared. We set off down the lane towards the village. It looked idyllic in the evening haze, a place where one could settle down and start a family. Now wasn't that a melancholy thought? And yet, as we came closer, something struck me as peculiar. I couldn't put my finger on it, though. The village was clearly occupied. Smoke was rising from the chimneys, and I caught the smell of food being cooked on a wood-burning stove, which brought a homely memory of childhood. A dog began to bark as we approached. Well, I said, it isn't the home counties. The doctor gave a grunt. He was preoccupied, of course, not just enjoying the peace and quiet, but savouring an unfamiliar place. From the gold-tinged clouds above us to the flowers beside the road, there was always something new to see. He never tired of it. For myself, I was relieved to see somewhere like this still standing after the storm of war had passed. It seemed to sum up English steadfastness. And yet, there was that niggling sensation of something being out of place. I pondered it as we entered the main street. It seemed narrower than normal, and the houses loomed above us, cutting off the evening light. I took the glasses off. There were cobbles underfoot. We reached a corner, and I saw a little boy in front of us. He was standing close against the wall and looking up the side street, his body rigid, obviously afraid. As he sensed our presence, he looked around quickly. He must have been 5 or 6 years old. His mouth was pinched shut, and his eyes were wide. Hello, I said, bending forward with a smile. Are you lost? He looked from me to the doctor and stood staring for a moment. Then he looked back at me again and slowly shook his head. What's wrong then? I asked gently. I don't want to go past the picture on the wall, he said in a small voice. What picture? I looked past him. There was a poster of some kind on the wall a little further up the street. You look like a brave boy, I said. I'm sure a picture doesn't frighten you. He chewed his lip unhappily. I reached out for his hand. A moment's hesitation, then he took it. Is your home this way? I asked. Come on, I'll make sure you get back safe. I led him down the dingy little street. The doctor followed. I could almost sense him mastering the urge to tell the poor child to pull his socks up in that jovial way that doesn't really help. What's your name? I asked the boy. Peter, he almost whispered. Pleased to meet you, Peter. My name's Constance. We'd almost reached the poster now. I expected him to turn his face away, but instead he sneaked to look at it, as if his fear compelled him. I looked as well and almost flinched. It wasn't the kind of thing a child should see. It was what I could only call a dark and stormy painting of a ghastly skeleton astride an aircraft of some kind. It was about to hurl a bomb down at a lit-up house below it. The message scrawled across it was, "The enemy sees your light. Black out." I paused to stare despite myself. Whoever would put that on a public wall? I think you'll find, the doctor said beside me, that the horrors of your war won't be forgotten for a while. I glanced at him, then back towards the poster, and in that moment something changed. The words became a blur, then they snapped back into focus, in a different language. I knew how the TARDIS can trick one's brain, but sometimes the human brain can trick it back. The words scrawled on the poster now were foreign, but I still recognized them, and I understood them too. Der Feind sieht dein Licht verdunkeln. The writing on the wall was German. I realized I was squeezing Peter's hand. You're right, I told him. That's a horrid picture. I know it's meant to warn us, miss, about the English coming in the night. I turned to the doctor. It looks like we're in the wrong place, I said as brightly as I could. He looked a little shifty. Or the right place at the wrong time, he allowed. We had to get back to the TARDIS, but I'd promised Peter I would see him home. I hustled him along the street, my heels loud on the cobbles, and felt there must be eyes at every window watching us. He pointed his house out, and as we went towards it, the front door opened and a woman came onto the step. Her anxious face convulsed as she saw Peter, a mixture of anger and relief. "There you are," she said. "Where have you been?" She turned her gaze towards me and the doctor. I didn't know what to say to her. For a moment I was horribly convinced that if I spoke, the words would come out in English as the TARDIS lost its influence over me. The woman stared at us. Her eyes were frightened. "I don't know you," she said. "Of course you don't," the doctor said. "We were merely passing through here on our way to... somewhere else." She glanced up and down the empty street, then beckoned. "Come in," she hissed, "before they notice you." My fear really gripped me then. Who did she mean by they? Were there Gestapo agents in the village, or was it just her fellow Germans looking out for saboteurs and spies? These people were the followers of a madman. His ranting and raging had won them over. Were they to find an enemy in their midst, they would surely set upon her without mercy. I quailed at the thought of going through that door, but there didn't seem to be much choice. We followed her inside. She shut the door and sagged against it. "It isn't safe for strangers here," she said. A man emerged from the front room. "It isn't safe for anyone," he said. He studied us, then jerked his head at Peter. "Go to your room," he said. "You've had your mother worried sick." His brusque tone brooked no argument. boy scurried upstairs. The man returned his gaze to us and frowned. If it had been up to me, I would have shut the door on you. Are you mad to draw attention to yourselves? He gestured to the doctor's coat. The doctor looked disdainful. Conformity is a tedious state, I find. That's an easy thing for you to say. We have two children here.
Yes, and we brought one back to you, I said.
We are grateful, Peter's mother said. Was he lost? I shook my head. He was just down the street, but he didn't want to pass that air raid poster. I might have known, she said. It gives him nightmares, but he keeps going back to look at it, as if to dare himself. He's convinced himself, you see, that in the blackout, that skeleton comes off the wall and crawls over the roofs looking for light. I suppose these are frightening times, the doctor said. For everyone. The man shrugged. We've been spared so far, he muttered. But night after night we hear those bombers going overhead, and sometimes there's a glow on the horizon like a sunset, when the sun has set long since. I dropped my gaze and felt absurdly guilty, as if he might sense I was complicit. Sense it, or see it written on my face. So the war hasn't reached your village, said the doctor. It seems a rather peaceful place to me, yet you both seemed very troubled that your son was still outside. The man glanced at his wife uneasily. Since you're here, you might as well come through and have a seat. I'd prefer that you left here after dark, but there are things you need to be aware of first. We followed him into the living room. The day was fading, but he drew the heavy curtains before switching on the light. His wife came in and closed the door behind her, as if being in her own home wasn't privacy enough. There were some rather guarded introductions. His name was Ulrich, hers Johanna. I said my name was Constance, like the lake, then remembered that Lake Constance was the Bodensee in German, which probably explained their puzzled looks. But they seemed impressed to meet someone who called himself the Doctor. I guessed that German intellectuals were somewhat rarer than they used to be. So, said Ulrich, in the past few days, strange things have happened. Two men from the village have been found dead, and another was struck blind. They had all been out alone after the blackout. No mark on any one of them except what happened to their eyes. I felt a chill that cut through the numb fear of my surroundings. Did the blinded man say anything? I asked. Ulrich shook his head. No, miss. Since that night, he hasn't said a word. In the pause that followed, somebody tapped softly on the door. I almost jumped. A little girl came in. She eyed me and the doctor curiously, then turned to her parents. Have you seen Mitzi? That blessed cat will come home when it suits her, Ulrich said. When are you going to read us a story, Mummy? When our guests have left, Johanna said. Now go and make sure the curtains are all drawn.
I already have, the girl said. Peter made me. He said the skeleton will come and get us if we show the smallest bit of light.
Although she didn't look much older than her brother, her indulgent tone suggested that she didn't share his fears. It's the English we need to worry about, said Ulrich. He glanced at me as if for confirmation, and I nodded very earnestly. The girl went out again and closed the door. That's Sophie, said Johanna, rather proudly. I smiled back, but it felt forced. I felt like such an interloper then. And that was what I was, of course, one of the dreaded English. But this wasn't how I saw the enemy. Well, this sounds most intriguing, said the doctor. It's a grim time for your country, naturally, but people don't start dying for no reason, not even in the middle of a war. And it involved their eyes, you say? Ulrich hesitated. Of course, the security police discourage questions, but I know the local doctor and he told me what he saw. He said that their eyes had shriveled in their sockets as if the very light had been sucked out of them. The doctor absorbed that
looking thoughtful. And have there been other strange things seen or heard? The couple exchanged glances. There was something, said Johanna. In the night, about 2 weeks ago, there were two loud bangs, then a rushing sound. We thought it was a British bomber falling, but in the morning we could see no sign of it. No doubt you've heard the rumours, Ulrich added, about these wonder weapons which the leader has been holding in reserve. Perhaps it was one of them being flown in secret? It sounds like something supersonic. The doctor caught my eye. Doesn't the V2 make a noise like that? I gave him a blank look. Ah, yes, he added hurriedly. Perhaps you're not familiar with those yet. Anyway, said Ulrich, when you leave, you should be careful. We should let them stay, Johanna said. Please don't worry about us, the doctor said. We don't want to put your family in danger, and Constance and I can look after ourselves. Mrs. Clark, I almost chided him. I hoped I looked unruffled, but I could feel my hands clasped tightly in my lap. He wasn't just being generous. He wanted to know what was out there, and he was bold enough to look it in the eye. We waited in a rather awkward silence. I imagined the darkness thickening outside. There would be no street lamps lit, no windows glowing, just a cloak of shadow trying to hide us from my countrymen. Johanna switched the wireless on, but a sentimental singer didn't make the atmosphere more comfortable. I'd better read the kids their story, said Johanna. She went to the door. Come on, Sophie, time for bed.
We have to let Mitzi in first, said Sophie.
I heard her trotting off and then the back door being opened.
Mitzi!
She called out for the cat. There was a pause and then she squealed in fright. That got us all up from our chairs. The back door was slammed shut. Ulrich went through to the kitchen and I was at his heels. Sophie was in her mother's arms, her face as pale as paper.
There's a monster in the yard, she whimpered.
Bolt the door, quick, now, the doctor said. I noticed the cat, which had made it through the doorway and was crouching in the corner, glaring with its hackles up. Ulrich moved to bolt the door and stood against it, listening. He turned to his daughter. What was it you saw?
A black thing, she sobbed. When I called Mitzi, it came after her across the yard like a spider with two legs.
Something thumped against the door. Ulrich recoiled from it. It was followed by a scraping noise. Then silence fell outside. We retreated to the far side of the kitchen. I stared at the door, expecting a renewed assault on it.
Mummy, called Peter from upstairs. What's happening?
None of us could answer. The doctor touched my shoulder. The light's changing, he said. I didn't notice it at first, but he was right. The glow seemed duskier. I glanced up at the bulb. It seemed no weaker, and yet shadows were gathering in the corners, spun like ghostly cobwebs while we watched. Is it draining the electricity? I wondered. He studied the bulb and shook his head. The filament's still bright. It's almost as if the light is being drawn out of the room. He turned to the others. Have you got a match? There was a box of matches on the worktop. Johanna handed it to him. He struck one and advanced towards the door. As he brought the golden flame up to the keyhole, it flickered as if there was a draft, then bent and elongated as I watched, not away from the hole, but into it, becoming vivid blue as it was sucked away from the charred matchstick, leaving a wisp of smoke that rose up straight. Remarkable, the doctor said, and for a horrid moment I thought he was going to kneel and put his eye against the hole. But he looked round for the key instead and fitted it in place. The kitchen seemed to brighten. There was no sound from outside.
Mummy! Peter called again.
I'll go to him, I said, and dashed upstairs, aware we might have to evacuate the house at any moment. He was standing in the doorway of his room. It's all right, I said. Your sister had a little fright, that's all.
Is the Skellington outside?
he asked.
Of course not, I said firmly. He's only a picture on the wall.
I was listening for sounds downstairs, but then I heard a noise from overhead. A scuttering like a bird's claws on the roof tiles, but more noise than any bird would make. We both looked up. I felt an icy thrill. Come on, I said and took his hand. We went towards the staircase. Suddenly a window smashed. I looked round with a start and Peter whimpered, trying to tug me onward.
It's Sophie's room. She didn't close her curtains properly.
Her door was at the far end of the landing. I heard clumsy movements and more glass breaking. My heart was urging me to run, of course, but my head wanted to wait and see this uncanny intruder. After travelling with the doctor, I had come to share his curiosity. The door flew open. One glimpse was enough. I turned and fled. It was something very tall and gaunt, as black as a burnt stick, and draped in a garment of some kind. Its mouth gaped like a hole. As we reached the stairs, I risked another glance over my shoulder. The landing behind us was growing dim as the light itself was leached out of the air. The overhead bulb fought the suction for a moment, then popped and plunged us into darkness as we ran downstairs.
It's in the house, I called. The doctor came into the hallway. It's gobbling up the light, I told him, still not quite believing what I'd seen. Put the lights out now, he ordered. That's what draws it.
Peter clung to me as I hit the light switch in the hall. We hurried on towards the darkened kitchen while the doctor leaned into the living room to switch the light off there before he followed. For a moment, as we waited in the gloom, I could hear no more than my own frantic heartbeat. But then there was the creak of footsteps coming down the stairs.
Out into the yard, the doctor whispered.
I heard Ulrich fumbling blindly for the bolts. The footsteps reached the bottom of the stairs and there was silence, but I sensed the presence in the passageway. Slowly it began to move towards us. Then the back door opened and I ushered Peter through into the yard. The gloom outside was solid but less stifling. The sky above was thick with stars, which gave things in the yard a ghostly tinge.
Come on, children, quickly, said Johanna. She was trying to keep the quaver from her voice.
The cat hissed in the darkness of the kitchen. I imagined its hairs bristling and the hairs on my neck rose up in sympathy.
Mitzi!
Sophie called, and then she broke free from her mother and darted back into the house.
Sophie, come back! I cried.
Johanna echoed me and Ulrich made to follow her, but then he froze and stumbled back a step. A moment later, a black shape crossed the threshold and stepped into the yard with Sophie clutched in its thin arms.
Don't look at it, the doctor called. It'll see the light reflected in your eyes.
I thought of what Ulrich had said to us about the previous victims of this thing. Then I remembered the glasses I'd been wearing. I took them out and put them on. They made the dark more dense, but I could just make out the outline of the figure, with Sophie clasped in its embrace. Fear had turned the child as rigid as a doll. I was glad I couldn't make out any details, but in my mind, I saw that painted skeleton again, dismounted from the bomber it was riding, and come down to stalk its enemies on Earth. Johanna was holding Peter now. I stepped away from them and the creature turned its head to follow me. There had to be some way I could distract it. It was drawn to light. It fed on it. Of course, my navy torch. It seemed so small as I drew it from my pocket, but I held it out and thumbed the switch. The narrow beam of light shone on the thing. I had a brief impression of a cowl over its head and a ragged shroud around its shoulders. Then the yawning mouth sucked in the light. The creature prowled towards me and I backed away from it.
Watch out, Mrs. Clark, the doctor called.
I kept the switch pressed down. I was half aware of Ulrich running back into the house. The light from the torch was getting weaker as the battery drained with incredible speed.
Put her down, I yelled, as if the thing could understand me.
but I sensed that not even the TARDIS could translate the thoughts in that dark head. Then Ulrich came back out, holding a lantern. He waved it, and the thing swung round as an amber glow was cast across the yard. Then he hurled the lamp towards the woodshed. It smashed and spilled out burning paraffin. The wood caught light and cast a dancing aura. The creature turned, let Sophie fall, and strode towards the flames. Ulrich ran to pick her up, and we all drew back and watched it, silhouetted like a scarecrow as it sucked the energy out of the blaze. The flames seemed to lose colour, turning ghostly. They clawed their way over the logs, then withered like old fingers and curled back. Then we heard somebody shouting in the street outside. The local air raid warden, I suppose. He found his way round the house, then saw the grisly figure and recoiled. The creature kept on feeding at the bonfire, and I wondered if the flames would spread or be devoured themselves. The warden soon came back with reinforcements, two order policemen armed with pistols.
"What do you think you're doing?" shouted one. "Stop him! He's a saboteur!" cried Ulrich.
The creature rounded on the newcomers and they opened fire. A gun crack stung my eardrums and made both the children start to cry as their parents held them close. A round whined past my ear like a mad insect, but the dark shape sprang clear, spider-quick on the woodshed roof. It plunged into the night. The men pursued it. I heard their shouts. Another gunshot flickered in the gloom. I snatched off my dark glasses and the starlight filled my gaze. It felt like coming up for air.
"Mrs. Clark, it's time we went," the doctor said. We made good our escape in the confusion and were soon clear of the village. Everything was black under the starry sky. I touched the torch's switch, but it produced barely a glimmer.
"Stay close," the doctor murmured. "I've a good idea where the TARDIS is."
We came upon the lane and started up it. The hedges loomed on either side. Their shadows made the air as dense as soot. With every step, I could feel my backbone crawling. There were no more shouts or shots, just silence now. I looked over my shoulder and saw nothing, but for all I knew, the creature could be waiting up ahead.
"What do you think it was, Doctor?" I whispered. I sensed him shrug. "Some being from the upper atmosphere. No doubt it was attracted by the glow of burning cities, all those searchlights blazing up into the night. It came too close and probably crash-landed. I imagine it can't survive in daylight, so now it feeds on photons in the dark."
"We can't just leave it here, can we?" I asked after a moment. That, as my Latin master would have said, was a question expecting the answer no.
"Alas not," said the doctor. "And there's no chance of finding it in this murk, so we're going to have to make sure it finds us." As I contemplated that unwelcome prospect, we heard a rumbling in the distance. Gradually it spread across the sky until I felt it throbbing in my teeth. I knew it was our bombers on their way to strike the Nazi heartland, but now I'd seen that heartland at first hand. It was a German family who'd helped us, and my own side was the enemy who scoured the darkness for a gleam of light. I peered up at the heavens but saw nothing as the black planes passed 3 miles above our heads. At length, the noise began to fade. By the time we reached the TARDIS, it was no more threatening than a distant storm. The doctor unlocked the door and left it open, the light from the interior spilling out across the field. "Allow me to recharge your torch," he said. I gave it to him, and he plugged it into the console. I went back to the threshold and looked out. Beyond the light from the doorway and the windows, the surrounding darkness was as thick as pitch.
"So," I said, "what happens when it finds us?"
"We'll give it what it craves," he said, poring over the controls. "It seems to feed on light addictively, so a surge of energy might overwhelm it. I'm supercharging your torch battery from the TARDIS's own power supply." He grinned at me. You'll need those insect goggles. I put my dark glasses on again. He handed me the torch. The last time I'd aimed it at the alien, it advanced on me and sucked it dry. It looked no more resilient now. I went outside and peered into the blackness. Earth and sky were silent now. We might have been the last two people left, but I sensed that the creature was out there somewhere, watching. "Is this going to work, Doctor?" I asked.
"Life, Mrs. Clark, would be very dull if we always knew that things were going to work."
Even as he spoke, I glimpsed a movement in the darkness. I raised the torch and gripped it in both hands. The stirring became a vague shape at the limit of the light, and then a muffled figure, stalking forward on its long and skinny legs.
"Ah, yes," observed the doctor from behind me. "Long bone growth and muscle wastage, marks of life at zero gravity."
And the ragged, hooded garment it was wearing was probably all that remained of a protective suit. But the sight of it and how it moved was fundamentally horrid. I braced myself. The doctor came and stood beside me, holding up his hand. I knew he wasn't sharing my revulsion. His instinct was to try and halt the thing and then communicate with it, as one being to another. But the creature continued to advance. I saw the gaping tunnel of its mouth. That would have been enough for me. But the doctor, being the doctor, just tried harder to engage with it. He stepped forward. "Friend, why are you here?" he asked. The alien seemed to hesitate, but then it strode towards him as single-minded as a predator. It wasn't his calm and steady gaze which drew it, just the glimmer of his unprotected eyes. I pressed the switch instinctively and almost dropped the torch as a dazzling beam of pure white light shot out. It was as if a multi-million candle-power searchlight was humming quietly in my hand. The alien came up short, but then its black mouth opened even wider, like a snake unhinging its own jaw. The light flowed into it. My hand was trembling, but I held the switch down. A part of me was worried that the torch would start to melt. The alien guzzled on the light, but the brilliant beam kept flowing. Even with my glasses on, the glare made my eyes ache. The creature took a step back then, but it didn't turn away. The constant gaze was clearly glutting it, and yet it couldn't get enough. I risked one step towards it, and the doctor's hand was on my sleeve. "Be careful, Mrs. Clark. It's absorbed a wealth of energy already, and that will have to go somewhere if it overloads itself." The alien clawed the air with spindly fingers, as if vainly trying to resist the force of its own greed. Suddenly, a blaze of light engulfed it, a blinding flash that sent me reeling back. It was like a bomb exploding, but quite soundless. No blast had torn my clothes or singed my hair. The field was empty now. I pushed the glasses up my forehead, still wary, but the thing had disappeared.
"What happened? Did it burst?" I asked.
"Perhaps," the doctor murmured. His arm was still half raised defensively. He lowered it. "Or it might have reached a new plane of existence. Perhaps we've fed it enough power to leave this world behind." It was time we left. We went back to the TARDIS. The doctor took a final look around. "Nothing can be destroyed," he said. "It merely changes form. Mass turns into energy, and sometimes it flows between dimensions too." I guessed that this was way beyond the grasp of human science. But standing there, on German soil, a poem by Goethe came into my mind. He wrote that we have a choice, you see, to let the things we crave consume us, or else remain a gloomy guest upon the darkened earth.